Linux Link Tech Show. The Linux Link Tech Show is on. Your link to the latest in GNU Linux and technology. An hour of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter. Free software, free speech, open source, open mics. Live from the Linux Link Tech Show studio, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up and take it away. Take it away.
Somewhere along the day, we ran into Paul Cooper from Open Advantage and got to speak with him a little ways. That sounds really stupid, doesn't it?
No.
At some point,
we also got to hang out with him for a long time.
Yeah, we got to hang out with
two whole days with three numbers.
We ran into Paul Cooper from Open Advantage and got to hang out with him a little bit, and here's what he had to say.
Oh yeah, Imagine Dragons.
Oh okay. It's the first time seeing it?
Yeah.
Pretty funny movie.
One of the things about how you guys had the same thing when having a kid is all of a sudden just kind of haven't been to the cinema for 2 years.
Oh, you know? Yeah, I know what you're saying.
So we finally...
What are you doing here?
I'm sitting.
We're noticing now more and more is movies are coming right out to DVD.
Yeah.
Like, it used to be 6 months to a year, and now it's like 3 months. We see commercials on TV. It's like, wow, that was... Isn't that even still playing in some theaters? And here they are. Is it compliant? Standards?
Work for me, man.
Does it pass the W3C tests?
Well, I didn't put it through the test, but it worked fine.
Who does the website?
Who does the website?
We do.
Yeah, you do it yourself?
So one of our down devices, a plain site.
Cool.
Good asking him questions.
What are you doing?
You had your headphones plugged in.
All right, we're here talking with Paul G. Cooper from Open Advantage. Who has come all the way from the United Kingdom. Where in the United Kingdom?
From Birmingham.
Birmingham. To man the gnome booth. Or gnome booth.
As well,
how do you guys pronounce it?
Gnome.
Gnome?
Yeah. But if you're in Spain, it's Genomi, I believe.
Genomi.
I met some guys, Spanish gnome users at Guadec last year, who kind of were educating me on the kind of correct and Spanish way to pronounce this day.
So you're with the Open Advantage Group, and can you explain a little bit what the Open Advantage Group does?
Yeah, we're a project funded by the Regional Development Agency in the West Midlands, which is kind of the area around Birmingham, the sort of larger area. And our mission, if you like, is to help any company in the West Midlands get involved in open source, where it's just... they want a firewall, they just want to use something, or whether they want to develop an open source project, or they want to commercialize and be an open source business. So we try and help people on all those kind of levels in any interest they have in open source.
Now, do you target primarily businesses, or do you also do government agencies and educational institutions?
Our primary target is business, and within that, the main target is IT businesses, because we feel that gives us a kind of multiplying effect. If we just help one, whatever business, a news agent or whatever, that's one person using open source. If we help an IT company start integrating open source into their offerings, then that's all of their clients are kind of benefiting from that. So we kind of get a multiplying effect out there. Having said that, that's our kind of main target, but we try not to turn anyone away. And so we have done work with some voluntary groups and community projects. And schools and colleges and so on. There are other projects within the Birmingham and West Midlands area that do focus primarily on those areas with open source. There's a project called MOST, Midland Open Source Technology, and they focus primarily on the voluntary sector and charities. And then our city council, has been doing a lot of work with open source in their library systems. So...
So how's the reaction been from the IT department?
Well, it kind of mixed. We kind of see a range of types of companies. So some guys are just coming purely from a kind of competitive analysis point of view. They want to just see what's this competitive threat of open source, and what features have they got, or what's the kind of compelling stuff about this this threat. Other people are characterized more as kind of their, for want of a better word, they're exploiting open source. It's this great technology, it does great things, how can we use this in our business to make money? So they might be a proprietary development company, but they're using open source tools within to, GCC or PHP or MySQL or whatever it is to build their proprietary solutions. So that's kind of one camp. And then you have the kind of people who then go kind of full into open source as they really kind of get into believe the idea of open source and fully contribute back into the project. So they might see might get involved in something and start realizing that it's beneficial for them, even on business terms, to start contributing into that project. And so kind of get this whole spectrum of things. And what we most like is people in those last two groups. People are actually, not just people are there looking at it as a competitive threat, but people actually getting involved in some way, form or another. And we just try and kind of help move them along if they're interested.
So what have been some of the hurdles that when you've had a client that is willing to take a chance and jump into the open source pool that has never tried this technology out before? I mean, what are some of the hurdles that you have seen that they've had to overcome?
Just the biggest thing is kind of getting used to the fact that it's open. And in a way, people don't hold back on them on their opinions or anything. So if you're used to working, I mean, even in a small company, you kind of have a hierarchy. You might have the senior developer, typically maybe the boss, CEO as well, and then the kind of junior guys. And so obviously, because of the nature of that structure, they're perhaps a little bit more reserved in their criticism for that guy and his code. And when those people then get into open source, they might put a patch out there and someone's going, what is this crap? And they're not, on the internet, no one knows you're a dog, and they don't know you're a CEO, right? So they just judge things on the merits. So that's one of the biggest things of people getting used to. And then all the other kind of features of open source that, there isn't necessarily a concrete kind of roadmap or release schedule, or things are released when they're ready, and all that kind of stuff people are kind of trying to get their heads around. But that kind of criticism factor of it is probably one of the biggest ones.
Now, Open Advantage is funded by government money, right? Public money.
Yeah.
Have certain parties within the British government been more receptive to open source and free software than others? Like, have you had a white knight, in your cause?
Yeah, I mean, we're not funded by central government directly. The money ultimately comes from central government. But the UK is divided up into, I think it's 9 economic areas. And those are each given money, and they have their own agencies who decide what the priorities for their area, because each geographic area is different. So that's who we get our money from, though ultimately it's from central government. But yeah, absolutely key to us getting any kind of money was that a champion in the funding body who didn't initially, when we first started talking to him, he had no idea what open source was. But as we explained and educated him about what open source was and how it might benefit the area, he really became our champion inside, dealing with the natural kind of skepticism and queries that people had, and helping us kind of get over that within the funding agency.
So my question is basically, are the politicians on the clue train when it comes to free and open source software? More so than maybe the United States, because here it seems that it's a little more resistant to government.
Right. I would say in Europe as a whole, open source is quite a understood political issue amongst European government. In the UK, it's probably somewhere in between that and the US, in that there's a growing understanding, and there's still a lot of that kind of resistance, kind of old school mentality, and probably, that kind of lobbying from big proprietary companies. But yeah.
Over here, it seems to be creeping into the public sector and the government sector a little bit. Also, the military seems to be using different pieces of software. It seems that on the local level, that seems to be where it's really lacking. I mean, you heard the story about the guy in Oklahoma, Tuttle, who was completely clueless.
Yeah.
I mean, you could hit that guy with a clue bus and he still wouldn't get it.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't like to say that there's not someone like that somewhere lurking
in
the
sure
UK.
There is.
But,
they're everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. But But yeah, there is kind of a kind of growing recognition that you can't leave open source out, and we do have certain things that are at least nice on paper. Like the government has a published policy that all government funded research must, unless they can argue otherwise, must default to open source licensing.
That's fantastic.
And that there must be kind of that they must prefer or they must include open source and open protocols in the procurement process. Now that's great on paper, and it's making sure that actually gets implemented. That's the hard thing with any policy.
You see, at least here in Massachusetts, they were talking about the open document format.
Yeah.
And I think that is a great angle to play to try to get governments and public sector to embrace open formats and get away from proprietary formats.
Absolutely. And
because why should we be tied in to a particular vendor for our documents, which are public documents?
Yeah, and that gives a level play. You know, open standards give a level playing field that it doesn't preclude a proprietary solution,
exactly.
But it doesn't lock out an open source one either. So, yeah.
I know we spoke before about this, but not on air, about your funding.
Yeah.
Now you're government funded, but is that a perpetual government fund?
No, it was a fixed amount of money, £4.5 million, which is probably around $7.5 million for a fixed period, and that ends on at the end of March 31st, 2007. So just about a year from now.
So are you trying to get yourself again? Funded by the government one more time, or are you going to try and be funded by the corporate sector?
How do you expect
to do that? You have people like lining up, waiting to, you know.
Well, we don't exactly have people lining up to give us money, unfortunately. If any of your listeners anyone who's got some spare change, we're always willing to listen. But so we kind of got a range of strategies that we're looking at to help keep us going into the future. At the kind of lowest level, we have a scheme in the UK called the Knowledge Transfer Partnership. So our organisation is part of a university, and the Knowledge Transfer Partnership is about taking knowledge in universities out into the real world. The level of funding is relatively small, but it employs a graduate to work in a company, even though they're employed by the university, but they work full-time in a company, and they are supervised by a member of the university once a week, half a day a week. So I'm running a scheme like that right now, and I supervise someone who's working in a travel company, migrate their systems or add basically new capability into their back office systems using open source. So that provides a quite low level of funding kind of on an individual staff member basis. Then we're also looking at combining. There's a number of European centres that are doing similar things to us at various different in various different areas and in various different stages of advancement. So there's the guys down that probably everyone knows about down in Extremadura in Spain, and other regions of Spain, who have really pushed out Linux and open source into their government and education. We feel we're quite ahead in dealing with business and IT companies. There's guys up in Finland who do a lot of academic research and look at business models and kind of qualifying vendor capability and all that kind of stuff. And then some other areas which are kind of far behind in everything. And so we're trying to kind of connect up with those centres and perhaps look for some European funding to share their expertise with us and share our expertise with them and help kind of spread this more evenly across the European Union.
And the ultimate goal then would be to create an organization that just goes across Europe and helps people integrate their businesses into open source.
Yeah, and then again on the national level, we're restricted because of our funding comes from the regional agency. We can only help businesses within our region. So if someone from London or Glasgow or Newcastle or Manchester phones us up and has an inquiry, well, we do the best to help them that we can, but we can't really go into the levels of support that we do for a regional company. So we're looking to hopefully kind of spread to a more national basis what we do. But that's very early days yet.
So you're kind of like looking down the road to some kind of consulting type gig.
Yeah, I mean, so people might be wondering, what the hell do we actually do?
Right.
On concrete level, the main three activities we do we do kind of general seminars, general evangelism, getting out there, telling people about what is available in open source, what open source is about. how you can make money using open source, why you should be interested in open source, both as a developer or as a kind of consumer. Then we do consultancy in a number of ways. One is just directly with a company, might say, hey, I'm looking at content management, tell me about open source content management systems and help me pick which is the best one. We also do fast track, where we 2-day fast track training, where we just really go kind of quite high speed, and we just try and get people into a particular subject as quick as possible. And then we do more traditional 5-day training courses. So we offer the kind of 2-day and 5-day, because for a small business, maybe 3 people, to take someone out for 5 days is just kind of, you know, it's impossible. It just kind of slows the whole business down. So that's why we do the 2-day one, so it's not as much of a big hit. But one thing that we really have to be really careful about is that we don't do implementation and ongoing support, because by doing that, we'd really be kind of taking away business from whatever open source companies are out there. So we try and just make it as easy, get people started, get them going, make it as easy as possible for them to evaluate open source. So we might install 5 content management systems on our servers, let them play with it, and then they might choose one, and at the point they then want to implement that, then we have a long list of suppliers in the West Midlands that we can point them to. So
now, since you're government funded and you're doing a lot of education, a lot of seminars, a lot of advocacy, and you had mentioned that now you can also do 2 or 5 day training seminars.
Yeah.
If somebody's interested in one of those seminars, is that something that's free, or is there a cost involved with that?
It's everything we do is free. The only conditions are that you are a business or an individual living in the West Midlands area, which you can find on our website.
So if I lived in that area,
yeah,
and I was interested and you were holding a training, I could show up.
Yeah.
And
obviously, that's very popular, so we have to, it's a first come, first serve, so the places go quickly. We can't serve everyone, but
I mean, it sounds to me like that type of situation is almost like a no-lose situation for anybody in there, because it's free training, free education.
Yeah.
I mean, even if you had just a small inclination to say, well, let's check it out, you have nothing really to lose.
No.
And now,
only your time.
Only your time, and that's really valuable, too.
Yeah.
And it sounds like a wonderful project. Have you seen this type of project taking off anywhere else outside of your area?
Unfortunately, I mean, there aren't any other similar centres in the UK. I mean, as I said, there's similar projects within the West Midlands focusing on different audiences, the voluntary sector and the council. And there are a couple of others around Europe, although from what I understand, they work in slightly different ways, none quite the same as us. So as far as I know, we're fairly unique in that sense.
Now, see, I'm thinking about this right here, and if we did something like this in the United States, and one of the things that I would see as people saying or being against it is because, you know, okay, you have the government providing resources to you guys to promote what you think is a wonderful solution.
Mm.
Now, what about, you know, would it be fair to promote a closed-source solution, or government funding going to promote a closed-source solution?
Well... Well, first of all, we're not just kind of rabid advocates that's going to go in and rip and replace and all that kind of stuff. So part of what we're here for as well is to sometimes to quash the hype, as people kind of just get too, you know, open source now is in every IT publication, every online type of thing. People can easily get caught up in the hype of open source. They can start to get kind of incorrect assumptions. Oh, brilliant, my IT budget can go to zero and all that kind of stuff. So sometimes what we have to do is just kind of hold people back from that incorrect assumption. Just as maybe 10 years ago, people started getting hyped about the internet and wasting a lot of money going down.
That, by the way, that whole good. Brilliant, my IT budget can go to zero. Yeah, that's the company that I work for. Yeah.
But on the other, so, you know, we're not just kind of completely open source or nothing kind of thing. We also kind of sometimes have to, unfortunately, have to say to people, look, in your situation, open source doesn't really provide a solution, and so you need to kind of look at some proprietary solutions. Now, within the West Midlands and also within the UK as a whole, there's a wide range of projects that are using a whole range of software. So we have a sister project within our, from the same funding body, in our same group called iCentrum, and they tend to focus, they're about getting high-end technology into small business. and giving them access to stuff that they might not might otherwise be unable to afford to try out. And they tend to focus on proprietary solutions. So, you know, you can go and borrow tablet PCs from them running OneNote and all that kind of Microsoft stuff, or you can go and run a huge Oracle cluster on some of their kit, and so on. So, you know, there isn't the region as a whole and the UK as a whole doesn't just fund one type or another. So there's a balanced mix. So,
all right, okay, I see what you're saying.
You're going to edit this bit out, right?
No, we leave it all in. We'll leave the dramatic pauses for the audience to think of their own questions that they could ask themselves.
And
no, not yet. I'm wondering, you know, it sounds like such a wonderful organization, a great organization. Now, you're obviously, knowing some of your history, as after speaking with you and telling us that you you started off programming in Unix, and I'm sure that those type of skills are very valuable. But here you are working for a nonprofit organization, and obviously investing an incredible amount of your time. Do you do it for the love of it? Because that's what you firmly believe in. Are you hoping that eventually that you know, there's going to be more lucrative opportunities down the line? Do you see that? I mean, where does that, like, put, like, somebody like you is devoting an awful lot of time, which I could only assume is not generating a lot of revenue for you.
Well, I have a regular salary, like any other university employee, and
right.
I have that kind of safety factor. I work for a big organization, you know, like a university, the funding's guaranteed, so, you know, I have a... Albeit a kind of fixed end date, I kind of know for when we started for 4 years, I've got something to do, which, you know, if you're more of a contractor, self-employed, you know, everything's day-to-day. You know, I didn't have to worry for 4 years.
So when this gig's over, if this were to end next year, you'd still be employed then, or you'd be looking for another job?
I'll be looking for another job, yeah.
And then, like, how many other people?
But the weird thing is that there aren't too many jobs like this, right? So... I've kind of painted myself in a corner, but you know, I do try and keep up my development skills. I run training courses on Linux admin and web development and so on. So, kind of keeping my hand in there, but you
obviously have a lot of very talented people that are working this. Now, what's to say that next year when this is over, you guys just don't say, "Hey, we got some contacts. Let's do a consultancy. Let's take it to the next level with these guys." But that would be a problem, wouldn't it? Because then you'd be competing with the very people you tried to educate.
Yeah, I mean, we couldn't do that within the context of Open Advantage. There's nothing to stop one of our employees leaving and starting their own company, and you know, that's
right.
Kind of the nature of work. People do that all the time. So, as a university, that's the only area. I mean, one aspect of, like you asked about how are we going to continue funding, one other thing that I forgot to mention is that we could look to commercial activity. We could look to charge people for some of the stuff we do. And the main area that university feels comfortable with doing that is in the training and education side. That's the university's bread and butter, in a way. So that's one thing we could do is offer some of our training or offer more training on a commercial basis. But as a university, they're not really looking for us to... develop a kind of consultancy side. That's not something kind of they feel comfortable with.
Now, have you received support or you know, any type of resources or help from like the local LUG in that area? I mean, do you partner with them at all in some regards?
Well, one of the things when I started, I was slightly worried about being a member of the South Birmingham Linux user group. Was I didn't want to kind of be the guy who suddenly got this great big pot of money and then kind of like came and stamped these great big jackboots all over the LUG, which was doing quite well on its own, you know, without anyone else's help, you know, without any kind of great amount of money or anything else. So it's a kind of, I always kind of felt it's a difficult line to tread of not trying to be the guy who's kind of took over, create some kind of super LUG, and then the money disappears and then the whole thing falls apart. I really, you know, the LUG should kind of stand on its own aside from what we do. But obviously, you know, where Jono's a member of the Wolves LUG, I was a member of the South Birmingham LUG, and because of family and other stuff, I haven't been able to go so much over the last couple of years. But We, you know, all of our events are open to those guys, and so yeah, we have drawn upon guys we know in there who have particular expertise to come and speak at our seminars and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, there's some interaction. It's not kind of massive or anything.
And speaking with you, you've had some. You have a problematic employee right now, do you not?
Here we go. You're trying to get me to talk smack about Mr. Bacon, right?
Mr. Bacon.
Now, I have some quick questions for you. I was interested to know, like, I know you put on these big training sessions, and how exactly do you promote that? How do you get the word out? What is your avenue of self-promotion to get these businesses into? I mean, do you, like, walk down the road and say, listen, you know...
Hey, that's a good idea for Jono. One of those kind of boards on the front and the back.
You walk down the road and you say, listen, you see that point-of-sale system that you're doing there? We could do it better and cheaper, you know, or...
Well, it's a number of things, and...
You put posters on the, you know...
One of the adages, Scott, my colleague Scott Thompson, he's a co-founder with me of Open Advantage. One of the things we're kind of always saying to people is that free is a great price, but it's a hard sell, and we have to do it twice. First, we have to sell free software,
right?
And we have to sell our services, which are all free and funded by the government. So people are kind of doubly suspicious. What's this kind of software that I can just download and use? And why are you guys telling me all this stuff for free or training me for free? Where's the catch? When am I suddenly going to get this?
Right,
you know, the training's free, but the lunch costs £1,000 kind of
thing.
Do
you see, like, a lot of what Dan and I have run into with running a lug for so long and doing this as well is that people are extremely suspicious when you tell them it doesn't cost anything.
Yeah.
And I think there's an assumption of worth.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and I'm just trying to figure out, it sounds like you guys have you must have, like, the greatest job in the world.
Absolutely, yeah.
But it's sort of hard having a great job like that when somebody, you know, the average person looks at it and goes, you know, they're not doing anything. You know, what's the worth associated with doing something like, why would I want to switch to?
Yeah, so absolutely. One of the things
open source when it, you know, it doesn't cost anything, obviously can't be worth any money, you know?
Yeah. Well, one of the things we thought right at the beginning is one of the key aspects of a center like Open Advantage, if we're going to somehow make it work, is marketing is a kind of key thing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that can be a dirty word, marketing.
Sure.
But it's really important for us to be able to get ourselves known, to get open source known, and to get out there. So we do a lot of different kind of marketing activities. We have an email newsletter which people can sign up for to find out what events are coming up. We mail out to people, so we have a database of West Midlands IT companies, which what we tend to focus on. So we mail out paper stuff to them. We run promotions. So kind of a thing that we're running at the minute is to get people to come to the seminars. Is if you take one of our flyers to the seminar, then you'll get kind of one of those little USB keys,
right?
Preloaded with loads of open source software that you can then just go away and try out.
That's a good idea.
We give out, you know, we give out things like OpenCD and Ubuntu discs, and you know, we just try every kind of trick in the book that we can
bring
any
USB keys for us, though.
No,
but now, do you have your own little a marketing division?
Well,
you know,
inside
your company, or does it land on your desk? And you know?
So Julia is our marketing manager. Does a fantastic job getting the word out about open source in general and Open Advantage in particular.
I got one last question for you, Paul. In the UK, what do you think is the biggest Linux distribution? Is it Ubuntu? Or is it SUSE? SUSE is big on a continent, I know.
Yeah, certainly, I think Ubuntu is. We were lucky in South Birmingham Lug when the guys at Canonical had their first conference, which was in Oxford, which is about 40 miles from Birmingham. We managed to con Jeff Waugh and Scott from Ubuntu to come up and give us a kind of preview. I persuaded Jeff when I met him at OzCon, and I said, look, Oxford and Birmingham, they're right next to each other. It'd take you 5 minutes to jump in a car and come up. No, I didn't quite tell him it was 40 miles, but I managed to persuade him to come up. So they gave us a preview view at South Birmingham Lug of Warty before it came out. And I think that news just kind of suddenly spread like wildfire, and I think it's really kind of caught hold in the UK, Ubuntu. But there's
Debian's very popular over there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a really strong Debian UK community, but also, you know, we like I say, we meet all kinds of people. Some people have never seen open source before, and some people are really enthusiastic. So yeah, Fedora's big, Suzy's big. A lot of the kind of like resellers and VARs and people like that are kind of key in. Very keen on Suzy and so on. So, yeah, all those kind of guys are cool. In the mix.
Make sure you say hello to our friends at Lug Radio, the good guys.
I got a question for you. I don't know if we covered this in any of our conversations. Clearly, I was in a loo back there thinking to myself.
In the head?
Yeah. You are Open Advantage. You do a wonderful job of advocating. You're over here in a GNOME booth. How did that come? Why all the way from?
Well, really, I'm here to partake in Linux World, to go to conference sessions, to meet vendors that I haven't met before, and find out and get info that's going to feed back into our seminars and stuff. But I've been part, kind of peripheral part of the GNOME community since before 1.0. So, as I was reminding Miguel yesterday, where I worked way back then at Warwick University, we rolled out GNOME 1.0 in a number of our public, in our graduate labs, and so we were one of the first places to actually have a public usage of GNOME 1.0, I've had involvement and interest in the project since however long that ago was, 98-99 or something, and so I thought while I was here, I'm subscribed to some of the GNOME lists, and I saw Louis Villa's kind of plea for volunteers to help out on the booth, and I didn't see many responses. So I kind of thought, well, while I'm here, in some of the dead time in between sessions, and if there's nothing interesting on, then yeah, I'll help the guys out and do what I can. So
excellent. Well, you know, I want to thank you for speaking with us, Paul.
Hey, it's nice to talk to you guys.
It's been great, and it's been great hanging out with you the past couple of days too. I mean, you're a great guy. It's great to meet somebody, meet you, somebody your caliber.
Right, the stuff $50 is in the post.
Yeah. $75.
Okay.
But I want to thank you. I had a great time with you. Really appreciate it. And keep doing a great job.
Hi, this is Paul from the Linux on Tech Show. I'm with Lincoln Dury from Emperor Linux. Welcome.
Yeah. Well, hello. Thank you.
You guys have been in the business for a few years now.
About 7 years. It's going pretty well. I'd say that it grows every year, and that we're going to continue to grow for a long time.
You guys were one of the first companies to actually have desktops loaded with Linux on it.
We focus completely on laptops, and really what we're offering is a complete out-of-the-box experience. So you can go to our site. You pick a laptop that you're comfortable with, if you're sold on IBM's or Dell's or any other particular brand. And then you choose the particular Linux distribution that you're comfortable with. So, you know, we support about the big 6 or 7. And when you get it, everything works in Linux.
That's fantastic. Now, you guys really addressed the need, way back when Linux was still a little difficult to install. You guys were selling the machines with the Linux on it.
Right.
Where has been the most sales come from? From education? From engineering?
Well, it's really kind of a very broad spread spectrum. I would say we get a quarter from the government, a quarter from universities, a quarter from corporate, and a quarter from just individuals.
Fantastic. Have you received feedback from any of the Linux distributions, the commercial vendors, as well as the community projects?
We go both ways with them. Of course, they talk to us, and we talk to them, too. In fact, we had some people from Red Hat over here just yesterday looking at software suspend signatures to see if they can work on their installer a bit to improve how it behaves.
How about home users? Have you gotten a lot of individuals who are just looking for an easy way to get a system pre-installed with Linux on it?
Yeah. Mostly they are people who already have some Linux experience, but certainly it's being used at home for people who just want to store their digital photos on it, burn those to CDs, just using it to print, check email, things like that.
Now you guys offer support, right?
Right. Each machine comes with a year of tech support, and that's phone and email. And the people who are on the other end of that line are actually the same experts who put your machine together in the first place.
As far as the kernels and the distributions, do you use a stock distribution or do you customize the kernel a certain way?
We do have a custom kernel that we use actually across all the different distributions. But most of the other user space stuff in the distribution is the same.
Right.
So if you're using an RPM-based system, you can still use Yum or Red Hat Network to get updates.
Just as long as they're pointing to your repository first, right?
Actually, our kernel is named differently than the standard kernel. So even if you were to get a Red Hat kernel,
you still boot into it.
Right, ours will still be there. And the same thing with Debian and Ubuntu. If you have a Debian-based system, you know, you're going to go to your app repositories to get all your user space stuff.
Which distribution is the most popular?
It's really kind of a tie between Fedora Core and Ubuntu, right?
Really?
Of course, we also do Debian for people who require that, and Red Hat Enterprise and SUSE for the people who really want you know, the official backing of a big company.
Or more business-centric desktop.
Right.
Let me ask you, as far as certain devices, you guys have custom scripts to make the loading of, say, you know, wireless cards and devices a little easier?
Yeah, there are a lot of wireless cards now that have firmwares that need to be preloaded with Hotplug or UDEV.
And the iOS wrapper.
No, we don't use NDIS wrapper. All of our machines are natively Linux-supported, wireless, Ethernet, everything. Even our cellular modems for mobile broadband, those are all native Linux support.
So let me ask you something. When you get a laptop, do you make sure that the wireless card has native Linux drivers for it?
Yes.
You go out of your way to make sure that it is
right.
That way.
And in fact, in our relationships with IBM, now Lenovo, and Dell, we specify the particular wireless cards we want. So we get the IPW2915s and now the newer generation IPW3945s. And we definitely just don't get from them ever the Broadcom wireless chips.
As far as non-free software, if someone has a request to install a particular piece of software, say like VMware or Crossover, do you guys do that too or no?
We do that on volume orders if a large customer would want something like that. Generally, for a single order for just an individual, that kind of third-party software we would support if they needed help, you know, rebuilding the kernel to link to it. But wouldn't actually install and do that ourselves.
What about people that already have a laptop and they want Linux installed on it? Do you offer the service of, say, I come with my laptop, I give it to you guys, and you do the Linux install on it, or no?
If you have an older laptop, we can do that.
Right.
Generally, though, you'll find that if you buy a new one and send it into us, that would cost more than just buying it from us directly. Yeah.
Okay.
The markup is only a little bit over street price. I think most users will find that that's more than covered by the quantity of time they'll save in not having to set the machine up themselves.
As far as the market segment that you guys are going for, are you going for education, engineering, businesses?
Well, we certainly do sell to all of those, but we're actually open to all segments. We have people from every walk of life coming and getting our systems.
If you don't mind answering this question, what was the largest order you had to fill?
The largest order we've had to fill was about 100 machines.
Okay.
And we can easily turn around an order like that in just a couple of days. So we have a really, you know, expandable system by which we do this.
You guys are located in Atlanta, Georgia, correct?
Right.
So where in a couple of years do you see yourself going? Is there anything you guys have a target that you're trying to reach? Or?
Yeah, we have a target just to continue our growth, which has traditionally been about 20% every year.
Okay.
We're looking to maybe raise that. But I think we're on track to do that and to continue doing quite well, I think.
As far as the customer support, do you get a lot of people wanting the support and actually using it?
Absolutely. So we support a lot of things that the big distributions would find very problematic. Of course, with a laptop, that laptop is subject to being moved around, being plugged into a different USB printer several times a week, being associated with different wireless networks all the time. So we get a lot of calls for things like that, and so we do a lot, especially on the wireless front. We actually have our own, written completely in-house from the ground up, wireless control application. We call it Constant Network Connection, and it's written in Python. You can actually get that on our website.
Okay.
If you go to the Emperor Linux website and look for contributions, you'll see that.
I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, and basically it does everything that the network manager application does, but it is actually cross-distribution. It runs across all distributions. And it does WPA already as of today, right now. That's what we're shipping to our customers. So they can get on wireless and do a lot more things without having to call us. And that's something, of course, that we needed, that we could have a single application that would work across all distributions and give us really good control of wireless and moving from access point to access point.
Because wireless has always been a sore point.
Absolutely. And so that's the kind of support we give people, though. If you go to the Starbucks and you can't get on the wireless, you can call us and you'll actually get a real human every time who can walk you through it.
What if someone goes in, like, when we went to our hotel room, we had problems logging into the network, the Wi-Fi in the hotel.
Uh-huh.
We know what we were doing. We figured out what commands to pass to, you know, to our system to get it on there.
Right.
If I was in a hotel somewhere, say in Wisconsin, and I couldn't jump on the network and I call you guys, would you help me?
Absolutely.
It's fantastic. A couple other questions. Have you ever been approached by any of the bigger companies to offer support or maybe do some kind of a partnership deal?
We have done quite a bit of consulting for some larger companies. They're not name brand companies in the Linux space, and some of them are privately held, some of them are publicly held. But we have been doing consulting projects, some specifically laptop related, some more generally Linux related. But as far as big companies with hardware, certainly we talk to Dell and Lenovo regularly as they're bringing out new products.
So you have a relationship with those companies?
Oh, absolutely. We're an authorized partner and an authorized reseller with all those companies. So, for instance, when the new Dell machines are being developed, we get those machines probably 6 weeks before their public announcement.
So you check to see if there's anything that might be a gotcha along the way for some
right. So, for instance, you know, we'll get a really early stage demo machine, and we'll see right then that there are going to be problems with certain video cards, certain wireless cards, and we can either begin getting ready a support strategy for that, or just determine that we need to avoid that particular card in that machine.
Let me ask you, do you think you'd still have a business if one of the big boys came out and said, okay, we're going to offer Linux on the desktop and the laptops, mass quantities, with full support 24/7 starting now?
I don't think that would be a problem because I don't think the big companies have the capability to do that. Two things tell me that. One is that, of course, Dell wants to be a hardware company. They don't even like getting Windows support calls, so there's no way they're going to handle Linux support. And, of course, historically, both Dell and IBM several years ago tried Linux on laptops and then retracted that very quickly.
Yes,
Dell's actually tried it twice. HP's tried it. IBM's done it. And every time they find out that that isn't really what interests them as a big company. For me, it interests me on a personal level, and that's why we'll always be here. You know, I run Linux. That's all I ever run. I run it at home. I run it on my laptop.
Well, which distro do you prefer on your laptop?
Well, I have Fedora Core on my machine. A lot of my guys run Ubuntu. Some of them have even written their own from scratch Linux.
Yeah, you can do it these days. It's not that hard to do it anymore.
Yeah, if you've seen Peachtree Linux, that was written by a bunch of my employees on their spare time.
Okay. Oh, it's definitely come a long way since the early days. I remember my first install Linux was Red Hat 4, and you put it on an old Dell laptop, and I had to hack the crap out of the X3 configuration file to get it to work properly.
Right.
And I knew what I was doing. I can only imagine someone who was completely clueless doing the same thing. You guys make it easier for someone who just wants to get a machine that works right out of the box.
Right. Take it out of the box, and you're going to get suspended disk right away. The wireless is just going to work. The network manager is going to come up and say, I see wireless. Do you want to get on it? You're going to have access to all the other little things that, you know, they aren't big things, but they're important.
Yes.
Like brightness control on the screen.
All the polish, all the little things.
You know, little volume control buttons so you don't have to open an application to change the volume if your phone should ring. Those kinds of little things that at the end of the day really make having the laptop, that experience better.
Is all that stuff developed in-house, or do you use some more open source tools and customize them?
Almost all of it is completely open source that we've gotten and customized and really gotten integrated well into the machine. Some of the ACPI stuff is stuff we've developed in-house, all the scripts to handle events and things like that. And one or two things are drivers that are closed source, but they're not our closed source drivers. Everything that we've done of any consequence has been released. Some things like the fingerprint scanner we do support, but it is a closed source driver from the manufacturer of that fingerprint scanner.
Which is the most popular laptop that sells these days? I see you've got some Dells, some IBMs, some Sonys, Panasonic.
It's really an even heat between the Dells and the ThinkPads.
Yeah. ThinkPads are real popular with engineering and Linux.
Absolutely.
People.
And in those, it's really hard to say, to call it between the Dell Latitudes and the ThinkPads. But certainly, I have a ThinkPad as my personal machine, and a lot of our staff has the ThinkPads, the smaller ones.
Hey, have you looked at the new Apple Intel-based machines? I walk around, and one of the things that really jumped out at me anyway, I couldn't believe how many people are walking around with Apple laptops. It's crazy.
Right. We've certainly taken a look at them. I don't think we're probably going to get any.
They're expensive machines.
To run.
$2,000 to $3,000 for the new ones.
Right.
Yeah.
So I don't think we'll see any demand to run Linux on them, but certainly if that demand would come to us, if someone were to come and say, you know, I need a couple of those machines, we'll fill that demand.
Right. Well, I thank you for your time, Lincoln.
Well, thank you for coming by.
You're more than welcome to come on any time in the future. We'll talk again.
Okay.
Thank you. Sounds good.
Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you. We talked.
Alan says we went to talk to Ian Murdoch. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't even notice you had the thing pointed at
me. Do it, Alan.
Put you on the spot. Let's start that over.
That's good. We haven't introduced him yet. We're talking to the founder of Fedora.
Yeah. All right, let's get the show on the road. Hi, this is Pat from the Linux Link Tech Show, and we have Ian Murdoch, the founder of Debian, and now one of the main guys here at the Free Standards Group. Ian, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Welcome back, actually. We talked to you last year.
That's right. I can actually put faces to,
yes, to the
voices this time. Yes.
So how's everything with the Free Standards Group?
It's going well. So we spent the last couple of months putting foundation in place to do some really interesting things going forward. Spent a lot of time thinking about the LSB roadmap. So first of all, for people who don't know what the Free Standards Group does, we're a nonprofit organization. We essentially maintain open standards for open source. We're mainly known for the Linux standard base, the LSB, which is essentially a cross-distribution Linux platform standard. So pretty much every distribution, every major distribution is LSB compliant, which means that it passes a certain set of tests, which says, yes, this distribution provides the interfaces that the LSB requires, and application providers can then assume the existence or the presence of those interfaces when they're writing their applications.
So the idea being is if you code up an application, it works on every distribution out of the box.
Exactly, right. And for the most part, that holds true with Linux anyway. You can take just about any Linux binary and run it in just about any Linux distribution. But from a commercial point of view, we try to provide more of a formal a set of guarantees about what interfaces are provided, so that commercial ISVs can depend on those interfaces being present. We have a certification program built around this, so that the basic idea is we're working toward a world where an ISV or a software developer can write an application one time, create a single package, use the LSB interfaces, or statically link in interfaces that they need to use beyond the LSB. And then from there, that application, that single package, can be installed on any LSB-compliant distribution. And we have at present plenty of LSB-compliant distributions, and we're making a big push this year to get a bunch of LSB-compliant applications to work with those.
So they will be certified that they will definitely run out of the box without any issue.
There's a difference between certification and support. It really depends on the ISV. Whether it will be a sufficient amount of whether the guarantee will be sufficient enough to an Oracle or one of the really large ISVs, that's one question. But certainly to the smaller ISVs, the kinds of ISVs that can't say you must run this distribution for me to support you, and they're dealing more with situations like we have standardized on this distribution, we've standardized on Fedora Core, and we expect you to support our specific environment. The LSB gives them a way to basically support all these distributions without having to support them each individually.
So you want to prevent fragmentation to the point where people running different distributions are going to have problems running a particular program.
Yeah, I mean, essentially we want to prevent the Unix situation where Unix all the Unix variants had a common heritage, but from a platform perspective, they diverged to the point where a software developer or an ISV had to target each of them specifically.
Each vendor separately.
Yeah, so now, of course, the situation in the Linux world is nowhere near what it was with Unix. I mean, the differences between the distributions are minor by comparison. And really, the LSB is more about providing a set of guarantees around what a software developer can expect is present out of the box.
What particular libraries are we talking about here?
We're talking about the core libraries like the C library, the compiler tool chain, basic things like the ELF format, how you load an application into memory. With the release that's coming up, LSB 3.1, here at the end of the month, we're moving up the stack. We're specifying the beginnings of the of desktop libraries, so GTK, Qt, the various libraries that those depend on. Are now going to be present in the LSB. And moving forward, we're going to be moving up the stack more and more, adding more and more desktop interfaces. Ideally, we want to get to the point where if you are a desktop ISV and you're interested in targeting desktop Linux in the generic sense, you can write your application to the LSB and know that it's going to work across different desktop environments, GNOME, KDE, in addition to across the different distributions. So preventing fragmentation at the desktop level as well.
Which distributions are participating in this currently?
Virtually every major distribution. Red Hat, Novell, Ubuntu has committed to certification of LSB 3.1. Zandros, Linspire, Mandriva. I mean, basically across the board, we have strong support from the distro vendors.
Is Slackware LSB? I thought it was.
No, not to my knowledge, at least not to the most recent version. They may have been to some past version. But
What I was wondering about is if you have a distribution like Slackware and compare it to Debian or Red Hat, what you have particularly notice is difference in configuration files,
right?
And particularly the boot up strips. Does LSB, you know, are they saying, you know, you need to do a System 5 as opposed to BSD style scripts? Do they, is that outlined in the LSB? Can you be a BSD style distribution and still be certified under the LSB?
So one thing that's important to note about the LSB is that we don't include anything in the LSB until it's a what we call a best practice, right? So it's something that's already widely adopted. So you're not going to see something in the LSB unless it's also in Red Hat and SUSE and Debian and, you know, the distributions that I just mentioned. And, you know, we do have as part of the LSB specifications about, you know, the system boot sequence, you know, because it, that's something that's visible to an ISV. If you're installing an if you're creating a package and you need to, say, start a service at boot time, then clearly you need to know where do I drop the script in order for the right thing to happen at the right time. And there's also nothing to say that, you know, just because we specify a particular way of doing things like System 5 versus BSD, that you have to do them that way. Probably the best example of that is the package format the LSB mandates is RPM, right? Yet there have been, including Progeny, you know, instances of Debian or derived distributions LSB certifying, and certainly Ubuntu. You know, Ubuntu is working toward LSB certification. So all it says is when presented with a certain set of inputs, you need to do the right thing. So in the case of Debian and RPM, there's Alien, which can take the package and process it and get it installed so such that everything's working. So I don't know the details of the Slackware system, but it would just need to be able to take a script that an LSB package dropped in a particular location and know what to do with it. Right? There's nothing stating that it's got to adopt a particular component over some other component.
Okay. Oh, sure. So, I mean, this sounds like something that every distribution would want, standardization so across the board. Have there been any distributions that have been resistant to this?
No, not really. I mean, I think that some distributions have been resistant to certain decisions the LSB has made. You know, Debian and RPM is a great example. But again, I think it's I think a lot of it is misunderstanding. I mean, we're not saying that, for example, you have to switch to RPM, the RPM package system, in order to be an LSB compliant runtime. We're simply saying that if we, you know, if presented with an LSB package, which happens to be in the same format as an earlier version of RPM, you know, sort of stripped of the bells and whistles that don't have cross-platform analogs like triggers and those sorts of things, that you know, presented with the right input, or presented with a standard an input formatted in the standard way, you're going to do the thing that the provider of that input expects you to do, right? So we are not mandating any technology. We're not mandating any particular, you know, any particular component. If you wanted to, I mean, if Sun wanted to LSB certify Open Solaris,
they're welcome to.
They're welcome to, and they, you know, they would probably take a little bit of work, but you know, it transcends, you know, GNU and
what
those
license
sorts of things
they have
as well.
It doesn't
what
really make a difference,
have,
right?
I mean, if Microsoft wanted to ship an LSB runtime, they could certainly do that as well, right? And there's actually precedent. You know, you can download a POSIX runtime for Windows called, I don't know, I don't remember what it's called
Cygwin
anymore. Cygwin is another example, but Microsoft actually provide, I think it's called Services for Unix.
Right. Yeah. They were pointing them out a couple of years ago, I remember.
Yeah. I mean, all that is essentially is a POSIX runtime.
Yeah.
Right? So don't think about the LSB as just being a Linux distribution. You know, you must use glibc version X and GTK version Y and Qt version Z. These are the interfaces that you must provide. And however you want to provide them, as long as you pass the test suites, which test your behavior when presented with a certain set of inputs, as long as you pass those tests, you're in LSB runtime.
Yeah. Sounds great. I mean, just looking at your booth, I mean, we sit right next to you guys.
Yeah.
It seems like all the guys that are in there, they're all from all different companies across the board. You know, Intel,
absolutely.
Some of the different distributions, some engineers.
Yeah, so, I mean, the LSB, the Free Standards Group is a nonprofit organization. We are funded by virtually every company that has an interest in the Linux ecosystem, you know, if you will. And so IBM and Hewlett-Packard, Intel, Red Hat, Novell, I mean, these are all sponsors. And the LSB, and you can think of the LSB as somewhere between an open source project and a standards body, mm-hmm. right? And so, you know, we are financially supported by our members. And that support comes in the form of just cash, but it also comes in the form of engineers, right? So Intel has a significant number of engineers working on LSB and LSB-related projects, and IBM and HP do as well. And so it really operates in a...
Because it's in their interest to do
so. It's in their interest, right. I mean... It really operates as a sort of open source project. There are people who are just simply interested in the broader notion of a vendor neutral Linux standard and keeping Linux open and a level playing field. You know, all the sorts of issues that resonate really well in the open source community. So it's across the board. We have participation.
So the business community has been on board with that. What about just the Linux community in general? Has it been pretty positive response?
You know, I think that it's been positive to ambivalent, actually. And I think one of the things that we have to do better is showing how the LSB is relevant to, you know, the average open source developer. I mean, so one of the pushbacks that we've gotten is, you know, historically, the open source community views the LSB as this commercial standard, which, you know, may or may not be particularly interesting. It's probably interesting to, you know, the Intels of the world, but not really interesting to me. As the typical open source community developer. And you know, at the very beginning of the conversation, I said we spent a lot of time. I mean, I'm relatively new to the organization. We spent a lot of time thinking about the roadmap, the organization, where the LSB fits in with the larger, you know, not just the larger Linux industry, but also the community, too. How do we make it interesting to developers? Because at the end of the day, I mean, the fundamental goal of the LSB is to prevent fragmentation. It's to ensure a level playing field. It's to ensure that you know, you can be... You know, one or two guys start a Linux distribution and have access to a broad array of applications that'll run on your distribution without you having to, you know, build up into a big company in order for those ISVs to pay attention to you. So there, you know, there's a lot of the same themes that resonate in the open source community at work here too. We just need to do a better job of talking about those things.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but what it sounds like is, and I keep hearing this time and again, is a lot of commercial entities in Linux, the SUSEs, the Red Hats, wanna go in a specific direction and not necessarily, you know, have to worry about this huge mass of applications and libraries and everything and all this different possibilities. Like, they do respect choice to an extent, but they want to go in a specific and say, look, we can have all this choice, but our consumers don't really want
all this choice. They want to have, and our developers, people that want to develop for it, don't want to have to worry about all this different choice.
Right.
They want to go in a specific direction, which direction they should go to. And what you guys are doing, as opposed to saying, well, you know, we'll, for instance, we're only going to standardize on GNOME and use GTK and not worry about KDE or Qt or something like that. What you guys are saying is that's not going to matter. If you have just some guidelines, both parties can play.
Exactly.
Or everybody can play.
Right.
But we don't need this massive, we're trying to prevent this massive chaos
right.
that choice yeah. might bring about.
And, you know, yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, there's an easy way to create a standard. You know, if you've got two competing implementations, if you've got a, you know, GNOME and KDE, you just pick one, right? But there are, you know, different. There are large groups of people that prefer one over the other, and they have valid reasons for preferring one over the other. So you know, you can't realistically come in and say, you know, GNOME is the standard desktop or KDE is the standard desktop, because you're instantly alienating half of your market there, and that's just bad. You know, that's bad business. It's bad anything. And, you know, to think about it in terms of the internet. I mean, one way to make the internet work is to say, or 20 years ago, everybody's got to be running the same hardware or got to be using the same network devices that know how to communicate with each other, and you know, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter as long as they speak the common language, the TCP/IP and the various other protocols. So, you know, that's what we mean when we talk about interface, not implementation. As long as you adhere to the standard interfaces and provide the standard interfaces, it doesn't matter what your implementation is. Just like it doesn't matter if you're running Windows or Mac OS or Linux when you hit Google.com, because
it should all work.
It should all work because they're all speaking the same language. Okay.
I have one question.
Yeah,
we're friends with the guys from the Arch Linux, which is a small distro that just started up, John Vinay in Canada,
mm-hmm.
in Vancouver. What would those guys have to do to ensure that they're compliant? Besides, what resources are available to them if they wanted to do this?
So what they need to do is go to linuxbase.org. Everything there is available for download, the specifications, the test suites, information about how to run the test suites. It's a little more, again, going back to we need to do a better job of engaging the open source community, it's a little more complicated than it should be. We're in the process of simplifying the process of both developing LSB-compliant applications and developing LSB-compliant runtimes. But, you know, go to linuxbase.org, download the tests, run the tests. The tests will tell you, you know, you failed this particular test, and you can then go in and fix the implementation. It more often than not, that indicates you've got a bug in your implementation anyway, because a lot of these tests are descendants of the POSIX tests, for example, so they're not, you know, they're not new things. And for the most part, if they're taking their software bits from the standard sorts of places, they're probably going to be compliant already without too much additional effort. But the LSB is, you know, right up the alley of these smaller vendors, because, you know, if we can build an ecosystem around the LSB where we have a set of LSB-compliant runtimes on the one hand and a set of LSB-compliant applications on the other hand, and you can run an LSB-compliant, any LSB-compliant application on any LSB-compliant runtime, you know, that is the path for a two-person company to either get a whole bunch of applications to support their runtime or to get their application to run on a whole bunch of runtimes without having to test specifically against each one. Either one is logistically impossible to do on your own. So, you know, that's really the sweet spot of the LSB today, and where we're putting a lot of our energy and efforts, targeting the developer, targeting the smaller ISVs and runtime vendors.
So with the choice thing again, and you had mentioned that the LSB uses RPM as a package management, and if you're using
the Debian-based package management system. Alien is the road to go there. Given that, and you're saying, well, RPM is the one that they choose, wouldn't it be better to have a single package management system in some respects, ultimately, that you wouldn't have to worry about using a third-party utility like Alien?
Absolutely, but it's not realistic.
Not realistic.
It's not realistic. I mean, so what are your routes there? One, you could mandate RPM. That's not going to work. Two, you could mandate dpackage. That's not going to work either. Three, you could create a third one. That's just what the world needs, right? is a third one. And I think the important thing is where there is one firmly established way of doing things, you know, absolutely, you shouldn't reinvent the wheel. Where there are multiple established ways of doing things, you have to learn to live in the world in which you operate, right? So that's why you can't come in and pick one of the two desktop environments. It's just not practical. Or one of the two package systems is just not practical. But again, I mean, remember the separation between interface and implementation. You can have multiple package systems. There's no problem there because that's implementation. The problem is when you have multiple package formats. And there's absolutely nothing to say that, for example, a future version of Debian couldn't process RPMs natively, right, without abandoning the dpackage package system, the apt package system, right? I don't understand the resistance to that.
You could run apt on Fedora and on SUSE. I've done it, and it works fine.
Yeah. On RPM on Debian.
True. Well, I mean, yeah, and at a certain level, if the standard way of installing software is you add a line to sources.list and you run apt-get to install it, it doesn't matter if the package that comes across the wire is a .deb or a .rpm because, again, the interface or the user experience is the same. And that's really where standards are important, the interface level.
Well, then do you think an application like Alien would be able to unify all those different package management systems? I mean, because I know I've used Alien to do Debian packages from RPMs and Slackware packages from Debian and stuff like that. I mean, is that a way to go, you think?
Well, so I don't know about the packaging issue, but it is a good technique for splitting the difference when there are multiple implementations and, there's no clear winner that you can pick. And one side or the other isn't simply going to say, well, let's adopt the other one, which for reasons of inertia or whatever else just isn't practical. Take the issue of configuration, boot sequence like we were discussing earlier. What if there was a third way of doing things that wasn't actually a third way of doing things, but was simply a translation layer that went to one of the two existing things, right? I mean, I think that's a promising approach philosophically, and one that we'll probably take. I mean, we're not going to some of these things like GTK and QT. I mean, it's not a problem that there are two toolkits as long as you can, cut and paste between them, as long as you can integrate them with the desktop environment.
And that's getting there, right? Because
it's getting there, right? And in fact, I mean, there are multiple ways of writing graphical applications on Windows. MFC and Windows Forms. I mean, and they're all just, from a user's point of view, you can't tell what they're
written. Care what it is.
And that's where, today you can still tell if it's GTK or QT. We can get to a world where you can't tell without having to mandate one or the other. Now, with things like, boot sequence, you can't really allow one or the other because then you've got, for one thing, from an ISV's perspective, that's completely irrelevant, right? You know, which boot sequence is used. All they want to do is say, start this thing at boot time. There are valid reasons an ISV might want GTK over QT, licensing, for example. Or maybe they prefer QT because it's got better tools, you know. So really, it all depends, again, on what the ISVs needed to do. And in cases where providing multiple interfaces is fine, we'll do that. In cases where we've got to pick a single interface, we'll do that too. And in cases where we've got to pick a single interface and we can't just pick a single interface, inventing a single interface that simply translates into the two competing or multiple competing ways of doing things is a very attractive option.
Let me ask you how you guys operate. Do you guys have, you know, monthly meetings, a monthly RSC, or mailing lists? You know, do you discuss what the options are? Do you have voting? How does it work?
Well, it works like a typical open source project. I mean, there is a certain amount of structure. We have mailing lists. We have weekly teleconferences. We have biannual face-to-face meetings. There is a core group of people that work on the standards and the various sub-projects. There's a leadership structure. You know, I'm the chair elected by the LSB participants. I mean, it's not as rigorous as some. It's probably more formalized than others, but it's, you know, it's just your run-of-the-mill open source project.
So what do you guys do? You have releases of what the guidelines are, what the updates are?
Yeah, I mean, we have a roadmap which says, you know, we are, the next version is going to be coming out at, you know, around this time. It's going to include these features. So, for example, LSB 3.1 is coming out at the end of the month, as I've already said, and, you know, its main features are the core is now an ISO standard, and we've added desktop interfaces. We have in the works an LSB 3.2, that'll happen roughly a year from today, or a year from now, where we're going to be moving further up the stack and hopefully standardizing more GNOME and KDE type things. So, you know, we have things pretty well laid out from a, here's what we need to work on, and it's really very little different, not a whole lot different from what you'd expect in an open source project or even a commercial product. Management-wise.
From a hardware standpoint, are you guys going to have certification from the vendors where their hardware will be guaranteed to work with a compliant distribution? Like, for instance, you have, like, one of the biggest, you know, gripes people have with Linux is wireless. Wireless cards not working with everything.
Right.
Will they be, you know, maybe not wireless cards per se, but, you know, say hardware. Say, you know, the motherboard manufacturers or, you know, HP or IBM, will they be, you know, a set of standards, and will they be certified that whatever distribution that is compliant will work without any major issue?
So right now, the LSB mainly deals with the interface to software, and not so much to the interface to hardware. So the short answer to that is, in the short term, no, we don't really do anything for what you call IHVs, right, independent hardware vendors. Will we down the road? Potentially. I mean, we do hear a lot of interest in that. But the LSB has typically stayed away from the kernel. We tend to specify more the user-level runtime, you know, the C library and that kind of thing. So, you know, in order to address IHV requirements, that would have to change. It might.
So it's more from an application standpoint.
More from an application standpoint, right. Yeah.
Okay. Any questions?
Do you see a need for the hardware end of things like that, a certification process?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think the main stumbling block, I mean, well, so think about it from the point of view of a hardware vendor. I mean, supplying drivers and instructions on how to get those drivers to work, It's much harder from the user user's point of view than it is on Windows, basically. And so, you know, if I were a hardware vendor, you know, if I could take my if I could take my driver to a central place, get it integrated, get it certified, you know, this is going to work. You know, I could go into a store and see a certification mark on an operating system and a certification mark on a piece of hardware and know, okay, these two things are going to work together. I mean, that would be extraordinarily valuable. And, you know, there are a couple of stumbling blocks to getting there. I mean, one is that there's no stable ABI for writing device drivers.
Right.
And, there are that's intentional, right? The kernel team will tell you if you want to integrate a device driver, you should put it into the mainline kernel, right? You know, whether or not this is the best approach, you know, I actually don't think it is. Because, you know, one of the advantages of the open source development model is distributed development, and to say that in order to do something useful, you've got to centralize it. I mean, that just doesn't seem to fit. But, you know, be that as it may, that's the way it currently works. And until that changes, it's going to be really hard to standardize IHV ABI the same way that we've done on the ISV side.
So what are you running these days? You still running Progeny on your systems?
I'm running Debian.
Debian?
Yeah. I mean, they're
stable, never testing, unstable?
There never was testing. There never was a Progeny per se. I mean, there was many years ago, but you know, Progeny was more or less a custom distribution shop, and so I was always running, you know, I was running a sort of homebrew using the various bits and pieces of Progeny stuff we had. But I'm on a Debian testing now. Same.
So how'd you feel leaving the company you started?
You know, it was hard.
Yeah, sure.
And I didn't really leave in the sense that I'm still somewhat involved to the extent that I have time. I still believe in everything that Progeny's doing. You know, after 6 years, though, particularly when a good percentage of those 6 years has been spent trying to convince other people to give you money to work on what interests you, as opposed to actually working on what interests you, it was just time for me to do something else. So, you know, in a sense, it's like it was hard to do before I did it. So it took me, a lot of soul searching, a lot of thinking to get to the point where I actually made the decision to do it. But after I've done it, you know, I'm sort of beginning to understand what it's like to be a grandparent, right? Because I get to, you know, I get to pop in, I get to participate in some of the fun stuff, and then I leave and let them, let them clean up, and you know, so yeah, it was hard to do, but it was the right decision for me.
You look like a really busy guy right now. It seems everybody wants to get a hold of you and talk to you.
Yeah, I mean that. Yeah. It goes with the territory. You know, I'd be more concerned if I'm not busy, because that means nobody wants to talk to me. Yeah, there's, you know, people criticize me, but if I'd rather be criticized than ignored. Isn't that the old saying? So, you know.
Sounds like really exciting stuff and really important stuff that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, this is really, I can't remember if we covered this or not, but people often ask me why are you doing this? And if you look back over the years, it's really just a natural progression. You know, DCC was very LSB focused, and LCC led into DCC, and United Linux led into LCC. and you know, my interest in LSB and United Linux began as a small distribution vendor, trying to figure out how in the world I'm going to get the ISVs to pay attention to me. Because at the end of the day, I couldn't sell my distribution unless I had the support from those ISVs. I honestly think that there's a continuation from a sort of Debian philosophical point of view. I mean, the LSB is, you know, fighting the fight to keep the Linux platform open and vendor neutral and the level playing field, no matter whether you're, you know, a two-person Arch Linux or whether
big
you're
corporation.
A big, you know, a corporation, multi-billion-dollar corporation. You know, and that's what Debian is all about to begin with. Just keep an eye on the LSB, particularly over the course of the next 6 months to a year. I mean, there's going to be a lot of really interesting things happen. I mean, standards are just inherently not very sexy.
Not at all, but they're very, very important.
They're very important, and they can be interesting. I mean, if you think of a standard as not just a pile of papers which says, you know, you must do this or you may do this. You know, at the very beginning of any standard, there's always this very precise description of what must means and what may means. I mean, there's way more to it than that. I mean, think about how we as a community make the Linux platform something that is easily addressed by the commercial world and addressed in a way that doesn't take away from what makes the open source world, you know, the open source community tick.
Is,
yeah. I mean, because again, the obvious way to set a standard is to just say, okay, this distribution is the standard or this desktop environment is the standard, but that just doesn't fit with the way the open source model works.
Thank God the programmers are in charge right now, because we're getting it right.
Well, there's a lot of power in the bottom up. And we like to think of, the LSB isn't just a stodgy old standards organization. It's a bottom-up, grassroots, open-source community project, which happens to have at its heart the goal of making Linux a viable commercial platform. Not even a commercial platform, but just a viable commercial player, right? So, you know, watch this space.
Keep up the good fight. I mean, we're in good hands with you, Ian.
All right.
You know, we appreciate everything you've done over the years and look forward to what you guys are doing going forward.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you for coming on. We
hopefully,
appreciate it.
Hopefully our next talk I'll be talking about all the successes the LSB has seen. So,
hopefully.
All right.
I'm sure we will.
Okay.
Thank
good.
You. Take care.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
No problem. My pleasure.
Okay, here we go. It's the end of the Linux World Expo. We're exhausted. Our feet hurt.
Oh, yeah.
Alan is babbling like an idiot in the corner.
Yes, because it's way past my bedtime.
Legs and mouth.
So what did you guys think of the expo, guys? Did you have a good time?
Yeah.
I thought it was a blast, man. I had a really good time.
Really good.
Tiring, exhausting, but fun.
Good stuff.
Was there anything you guys, you know, jumped out at you that you noticed right away or really stood out? As far as, you know, the boots or the...
No, my feet hurt.
Well, we could always talk about the Back Bay chips, those wood chips.
Wood chips, yeah.
In the pavilion there...
Back Bay chips
they sold
Boston for burnt potato chips.
They sold sandwiches and they tried to pawn off these wood chips as potato chips. And they were disgusting from what I hear.
If you put some salt and ketchup on them, they weren't that bad. But you got that occasional really undercooked one, which didn't crunch, it gushed.
Oh, no, mine were all overcooked.
I didn't have any gushy ones, man.
Yeah, Dan was eating something else, that's why. Gushy. You got the one that was stuck underneath the pickle, that's why.
You got the one that they picked up off the floor.
Yeah.
You know, for convention center food, I didn't think the stuff I ate was that bad.
It wasn't horrible.
The hot dog wasn't that great, but the meatball sub was pretty good.
Because the hot dog downstairs was, like, warmed over last week.
The tuna sandwich that I had was really good.
Yeah, that was good.
Then again, they served it with the infamous Back Bay chips.
which of course came out of the wood chipper first thing fresh this morning.
Or at least I saw some guy. I saw the groundskeeper putting the chips out on the
mulch.
Covering the
it was mulch.
Now, one of the things, and I think I've said this before. Where's the recorder?
It's right here.
It's right there. Oh. Just scream at it.
I thought it was on the floor before.
That's because Pat had to get it.
One of the things that really disappointed me, and this happened time and time again, was the sheer number of presenters using both Windows and OS X.
Right.
And it was just blatant in your face.
Well, should we mention names?
Oh, I already did on my weblog.
Well, it's Slashdot.
Slashdot not only did all the Windows, all the presentations
on
Windows, they were then running an Xbox the last day.
Yeah, I enjoyed that though. I was watching
Sugar Forge was the big one, the one that I kept seeing, you know, booting up their 32-inch big screen freaking display with XP on it.
We're calling you out, man.
Well, we're calling them out. You gotta remember, half these people that go...
It's bad form, man. Don't be in the .org pavilion for crying out loud. This is the .org pavilion for Linux community members. And you go in there and you
boot up Windows.
Freaking XP. Come on, man.
Lame.
At least use BSD or something like that, you know?
Yeah, I didn't see a lot of PPC Linux. Or Apple Intel iBooks. I don't even know if I saw an Apple Intel iBook there or not. But the only other person I saw that was running PPC Linux was the Gen 2 folk.
Yeah, he had a G5.
And the Fedora guys.
And the Fedora guys, sorry.
So there's three. Oswald, you.
Right.
Gen 2 and Fedora. For sure. Now, there are a lot of MacBooks floating around.
Yes, there were.
I didn't pay real particular attention to the other ones, whether or not they were running Linux or not. I mean, I could deal with BSD, especially if it's an open source project that they're demoing and, you know, it runs on Linux or BSD.
So a lot of ThinkPads.
Yes, the other big one was, like, all the really cool people there had ThinkPads, like me, and Nat.
Yeah, Nat had a ThinkPad.
And Nat and Miguel and the GNOME guys and...
The Sony that Paul had was sweet.
That was nice. Yeah. Nice little really monitor. Nice. That's an expensive model that he had, man.
Yeah, speaking of the Windows thing, the APC guys had a really good idea for a way to you to go around and do their own. The presentation through APC was all automated, mm-hmm. but it was running on Pocket PCs
right.
with Windows CE. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if there would have been
a
way to get around
the tour?
No, I didn't take the tour.
I didn't get a chance to take it either. I really didn't.
I wasn't going. You know,
we didn't have time, man.
Too much stuff going on.
Isn't it amazing? We went there for 4 days, didn't have time to walk through, you know. I walked through the place like twice, you know.
Well,
it was like 20 minute trips.
Yeah.
Didn't have a chance to, like, stop and listen to any presentations or anything like that.
Zero presentations.
Nope.
We were too busy, man. Manning our booth and lining up interviews and doing the interviews.
Yeah, a lot going on.
It seemed like the swag really came out on the last day.
It
was a lot easier to get.
I got most of mine.
If I had to describe the 3 days, the first day was the most crazy day because there was just so many people. The second day, it really dropped off. That's when all the suits were walking around. And on the third day, it was all the scavengers going around for whatever, you know, swag
like Yeah, like us.
Like us.
Yeah, and we gave away all the t-shirts.
Mm-hmm. T-shirts are gone, all the CDs are gone. We sold quite a bit of DVDs. And the stickers, we still have some.
I like the people that come up and won't take any free stuff. It's funny. You know, it's like, here we're having a free raffle. Nah, I'm not into gimmicks. I'm not into toys.
You have some literature. I heard that a few times. Do you have some literature?
Go to the website.
Go to the website. There it is. Take the sticker with you. No, it's all right. Okay. You know?
What kind of literature do you want? Yeah.
It's a sticker.
It's a radio show. You know, internet radio, you know?
Listen
to it.
The last day I met this gentleman, he was an older guy, and he was really into running Linux, and he was so happy. He's like, oh, I've been looking for people that are into Linux like me. I'm like, well, come listen to our show, jump on the RC Turner show.
And aren't you in a whole building full of them now?
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry, Pat. Was he the PPC guy who wanted to run it on PPC?
No, that was somebody else.
That guy was real enthusiastic, too.
He was.
He was all over Dan, like Dan was, you know. Dan was stink on shit or something.
Yeah.
He was all over you.
And he seemed to have been running it for Linux for a while, and I'm surprised he didn't know that there was PPC ports. But, you know, I hope he you know, if he has any help, he's more than welcome to get a hold of us. And, you know, we could help him any way we can, point him in the right direction, hopefully.
Yeah,
definitely. So any final thoughts? Will you do it again next year if we get invited back?
Hell yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Do it with the other ones, too, if
hell
we could.
Yeah,
if
hell
we
yeah.
Could. If only they move more of the conventions over to the East Coast.
Right.
Because we got invited out to OSCON. The problem with that is it's completely on the other end of the world.
Yeah, it's far away, man.
The States.
Yeah, so all you guys out there that would like to see us go to OSCON, you know, start thinking about devious ways to get us some money so we could go. Because, I mean, that's really our stopping point, you know, our whole point is that, you know, we don't have, like, any slush funds or anything to dip into to go do this,
funds.
You know what I mean? There's no funds at all.
Even Linux World San Francisco, we don't have the AFA to go to that.
Right. Or Toronto.
Or Toronto, yeah.
But maybe Ohio.
That one
maybe.
We could probably swing. The
we
Ohio
can swing
Linux
the Ohio
Fest.
One. Yeah.
It's in Columbus in the fall.
We can do that one, probably.
Hopefully.
But
now, will we try to get a booth there, or is that...
No, that was right.
I think it's just like a conference kind of thing.
No, they have booths, though.
Did they really?
Yeah. Gomorex and a few other people went, don't we know?
Yeah.
To get more information on that.
Any last thoughts before we say goodbye?
Last thoughts? Boy, am I tired.
My feet are killing
me. 3 days, 4 days on concrete, running around, doing laps? Hell yeah.
Yeah. And my voice is pretty hoarse from talking to everybody. Mm-hmm.
Taking the tea, baby.
Take one for the team.
No, taking the team.
I got to go on my first cab ride.
And you never
second,
won a cab before?
I've never heard a cab before, before yesterday.
You had two cab rides then.
Because
three?
I lived in the country.
Right?
There ain't no fucking cabs where I grew up.
You hillbilly?
There's no fucking cabs where I grew up. And by the time I moved into a place where there was cabs, I drove.
Wow.
Never had any fucking need to have one of those.
Holy moly. With the F-bombs. Giving us the explicit ticket.
We got to work on that tag again. Yeah.
What did you think about the cab rides? Just being completely new to you, what did you think of the T and the cab?
Well,
Public transportation in that
public manner. Transportation sucks because I don't like being crushed in a cab with a dozen other people. Or dozens of other people. No, I've taken subways and shit before.
Okay.
On it 20 years ago, but... You know, I've taken those before. But a cab, we just never was a need for. It's too fucking expensive.
Speaking of the subway,
yeah.
We cannot talk about the subway without mentioning the nice gentleman who was thoughtful enough to make us feel at home by serenading us.
about missing the train
while we were waiting for the train.
Missing the train!
like that skit with Dave Chappelle where he has the crackhead?
His eyes were rolling back in his
head. The white paint right out of his mouth.
Was lit, man. Oh, man.
He had a bottle he was drinking from.
I think it was like kerosene or something.
Oh, I don't know what he was drinking, but he had a bottle there. I'm still trying to figure out what he was doing with a fucking nickel on the ground, nickel on the paper towel on the ground. I haven't figured that scam. There was a scam of something.
He was like...
But he was playing with this fucking... It was a ripped up piece of like brown paper towel.
Sit in the corner and get
it
all
down into it. And then he tossed
a
nickel on top of it, and he was like staring at it. So I don't know exactly
strange
what
things going on in the public transportation system.
You guys were up waiting for
the second one before we had to leave the train due to it being on fire.
Wait, was that the that was when the train was on fire though, right?
That was before we got onto that one.
Well, we got onto the one that was on fire. That's when the guy started singing, wasn't it?
Yeah, he was like propped up in the corner.
Yeah, so
he was in the corner, kind of hunched over, propping himself up from falling down, and we're all waiting for the train. And you guys were up front talking.
Yeah, we're saying that he should be the next keynote speaker.
He's rocking back and forth, and he closes his eyes like he's in a jazz concert, and he just starts singing it.
I tried so hard to figure out a way of like getting my phone out so I could hit the memo button on it, the voice record on there, so I could get him. I just couldn't figure out a way of doing it to like nonchalantly.
Speaking of fires, I think Alan is a fire starter. We had a couple of fires fall in this room.
Not me, man.
We had the fire.
Link was with me, man. I didn't start anything.
Yeah, where the hell were you guys? That's what I want.
Yeah, you were the guys that were gone.
That's what I want to know. These guys are gone, and Unisys starts on fire, and then these guys trip out again, and some poor woman passes out in the middle of the floor. They're hiding back behind another booth with a blowgun or something, right? Get that one.
Yeah, you said you wanted the pranks to start, right?
Right. Those Unisys bastards, they didn't give me a t-shirt. I'll light them on fire.
The restaurants we went to, I thought, were pretty good.
A little pricey, but they were good.
I really liked...
No, the
one today and the Thai restaurant.
The Thai restaurant yesterday.
I like that a lot.
Really good, and I didn't think it was pricey at all. It's like, was it like $7?
No,
that was really reasonable.
That was $9,
and it was
mine. Mine was like $13. Yeah, it was good.
That was $9, but how much for you, really?
$20. $20. I didn't get my change back properly on that one.
we had Dan and Jeremy running up the bill, drinking away.
Yeah, no, I was paying for drinks I wasn't drinking.
That wasn't yesterday, was it?
Yeah, it was.
Yes, it was. I paid for drinks I wasn't drinking. Sushi I wasn't eating.
This is how Dan's week went, right? Get here, start drinking. Oh, that didn't happen, did it? You know, he doesn't even know how many days we've been here now.
What are we doing now? We're drinking.
Drinking, yeah. Not me, man.
So I think we're going to wrap things up, and we'll see you guys next week at From Home.
Good evening.
Good night.